Okay, all right. So I guess I resume my hat as a chair again. And it's probably a good time to welcome Philip Smith and Carolyn Bresch and Rick Payne. They're going to be talking about the finance function and how it may be the same as well as being different. So we'll go through for another hour and then we'll stop for lunch.
Good morning. First of all, I'd just like to say thank you to the LSE once again for organising this conference and hosting it. ICAW is very pleased to have been associated with the conference for the entire 31 years and to the charitable trusts to continue to help with funding. What we're going to talk about today is the role of the finance function and the drivers of those roles. The work arises from asking both practitioners and academics what the faculty should look at in terms of its thought leadership programme. And it fits very well with Mintzberg's call that in order to help finance staff, CFOs, finance directors, we need to understand what they do. So we thought in terms of building our links between accountants in business and academics that we'd trawl through the literature. And very quickly, some themes started to emerge in the sense that the finance function seems to be always the same in terms of its activities and its aspirations, but always different in terms of the organisational arrangements, the way it's implemented, and the way things change. So those broad activities seem to be the same, aspirations the same. And these perhaps are illustrated by the following quotes. Now, these are in your packs, but I deliberately left off the dates and the authors, but I'm not going to make it into a quiz. So we hear from the ACCA in 2009, greater involvement in strategy. ICAW in 1993, that the FD's decision-making role is increasing. But we can go back fully to 1963, when the Shell deputy controller at the time stated his expectation that finance professionals would play would be players on the management team. Now, you might expect this from practitioners. It's what you'd expect to see from them. The academics have picked up on very similar things. So in a recent third volume of the Handbook of Management Accounting Research, we see James Sorensen referring to the growing strategic role. Back in 1983, Vijay Seth is looking at controllers making an increasing contribution to decision making. But fully half a century ago, as many of you in the audience will be aware in a seminal study, Herbert Simon referred to the aspirations of finance professionals to play a general management role. So why do these messages seem to be so consistent and persist over time? Well, we've been developing a model, which Dr. Philip Smith is going to talk through in a moment. Carolyn Bresch, who's now chair of the faculty at the ICAW, is then going to relate that to her experiences in senior financial roles. I'm going to make some concluding comments, and then we'll have some time after that for Q&A. So, Dr. Philip Smith.
Thank you very much, Rick. First of all, I will address the activities which we are suggesting are always the same. The principal research source was 21 large-scale practitioner surveys. Their key characteristics were that they focus on the role of the finance department and the role of the FD and the CFO. They cover from the early 1990s to the present day. They were generally global in scale, with some bias to the English-speaking world. It was possible to consolidate the results of these surveys as they cover broadly similar ground. In particular, three areas were consistently repeated. Firstly, the activities for which the finance function or the CFO was responsible. Secondly, the activities considered to be of high importance. And thirdly, the time spent on them. This core source was then supplemented from a wide range of academic and practitioner studies. So that's the source data that we used. I will now present a model of interrelated finance functions activities which we developed emergently from this source and which we are suggesting shows that the finance activities at core are always the same. The start point is operations, which I'm using in the broadest sense, covering all activities such as marketing, production, and research and development. The financial consequences of operations are financial transactions, such as recording of sales, payment of wages, and the raising of finance. These financial transactions provide the input to the box B, which we've called produce accounts. And in that circle, there are three main activities: transaction processing, producing financial reports, such as statutory accounts, management accounts, and tax returns, and financial internal control procedures aimed at protecting assets and ensuring reporting accuracy. I'll now move on to how the accounts are used. The first use that we're considering is meeting compliance and regulatory requirements, such as external financial reporting, auditing tax returns, and associated and corporate governance requirements. The red line shows how the requirements are defined externally, and the black line, the flow of information produced to meet these requirements. The next activity is to manage and control performance. And there are three dimensions here: profitability and value for money, cash and balance sheet, and tax. Now, this is quite a complicated relationship. So it starts with the management and control function gaining an understanding from operations of the dynamics of the cause and effect relationship between operational activities and their likely financial outcomes. This is undertaken in an interactive manner, which is reflected in the double-headed arrows. The management and control then use this understanding to determine the appropriate formats for reporting using management accounting techniques. The produce accounts activity then reports actual outcomes in formats which have already been determined by the management and control, including, as appropriate, comparisons of earlier actuals, projections, and targets. The management and control activities then analyses and assesses this input to provide feedback to operations. This feedback is aimed at influencing and directing operational activities towards being undertaken in a way that meets all organisational goals. And again, it's likely to be in an interactive manner, again shown by the double-headed arrows. A final point is that the activities of the management and control can also be influenced by the compliance and regulation requirements, especially where they have a direct impact, for example, in capital ratios for banks. The final two uses are the relating to the investors and funders and the development of strategy. First of all, the investors and funders. This relates to the requirements of external financial stakeholders, such as shareholders, bankers, and corporate finance advisors. The red line again shows the requirements for information and projection that they require, and the black line shows that being met. Finally, I come on to the strategy. The inclusion of strategy as part of the finance function activities was very much stressed by the surveys, and in recent years, risk has also been included as an important issue, perhaps representing the downside compared to the upside of strategy. This would seem to be because financial performance is the main measurement of success in a capitalist society. Although even in not-for-profit organisations, finance is central as it determines the availability of the resources required to enable services and activities to be undertaken. Again, we have the red line showing the strategy and risk identify the information requirements, and the black line, the flow of information to meet those requirements. The final point is that there is a two-way flow between the strategy and the investor activities, as the financial aspects of strategy development are a critical concern to external financial stakeholders. A final requirement is that resources are required to implement all these activities. There are two main resources that are required. Firstly, the people who undertake the work, and secondly, the systems used to process transactions and produce the reports. That ends the presentation of the activities, which we believe provides a useful way of categorising and organising the range of finance functions activities. And I'll now move on to the drivers. What we're suggesting is that while the activities are always the same, the organisational roles through which they are undertaken will be determined by the differential impact of a range of drivers. Consequently, for each organisation, the implementation arrangements will always be different. In the same way, the effectiveness of the implementation will also be different and variable. I will now consider these drivers. We've identified three broad interacting categories: accounting, organisation, and environment, as shown by the slide. As you can see, this is not a million miles away from the title of a somewhat well-known journal. Within each broad category, there is a long list of drivers with many impacts. Given this, while I will present an overview of all the drivers, I will only highlight their impacts selectively, just to give examples and a flavour of their own importance and complexity. The first set of drivers I consider relates to the environment. As we're all well aware, the market is constantly changing. This can have central implications for how the finance function activities operate. Examples include the need to change the mode of financial analysis if income and cost structures change, and changes in profile where increased capital market puts pressure on financial performance. Another area which is of particular importance is when hostile changes happen in the market, and this can lead to a range of implications that impact how the finance function actually works. For example, the CFO may take a higher profile as a turnaround specialist when times get tough. Or when times get tough, there may be pressure to reduce finance costs, finance function costs and size. Or there might be the need to respond to a loss of confidence when outcomes miss expectations. The next environmental driver is information technology. This covers all aspects of information technology, from micro development, such as the internet, to its use in individual organisations. As identified above, the use of IT systems are central to the operation of the finance function, as changes in IT systems will have a direct impact on how the finance function operates. Changes can be triggered by such things as new technical developments, previous systems becoming obsolete because of market changes, or through the need to integrate systems following a merger or an acquisition, so you've got different systems that need integrating. These changes can then lead to a range of consequences. For example, it can mean, if they work effectively, that there's reduced time spent on transaction processes and routine forecasting. This will lead either to the finance function being shrunk, or it may free up resources for more value-added activities. Another example is that roles get spread throughout the organisation as access to information becomes diffused through, for example, successful implementation of an ERP system. Or finally, there may be a lack of compatibility when new systems are introduced in relation to existing legacy systems, and this can introduce a whole new requirement for reconciliations of differently configured information. Next, globalisation. The example I want to highlight here is the particular tension between globalisation and national differences. For whereas globalisation provides pressures for convergence and arrangement of finance activities on a global scale, perhaps including outsourcing and shared facilities, national differences, on the other hand, can pull the other way, with local compliance requirements and management practices counteracting convergent pressures. Again, how this tension is resolved will have a key impact on how the finance function is set up. And finally, the overall operating environment, and here I'm covering the wider social and political trends. And a clear example here is the importance of the sustainability agenda and on raising issues of climate change and environmental sustainability. I'll now go on to consider the organisational drivers, as shown on this slide. The classification for the first set of drivers comes from John Roberts' categorisation of people, architecture, routines, culture and strategy. The final ones, size, ownership and sectors, emerge from the literature as being identified of specific importance. First of all, people, who are obviously critical. Examples of their impact include you get new people coming in, bringing new ideas. So that might, well, then they might trigger changes in how the activities work. And then there's the nature of the relationship between the finance function activities and other departments. And a particular area here is the relationship between the CEO and the CFO. There's other examples of the tendency for staff to empire build, so that will skew how the finance functions works, and also the traditional cognitive conflict between the sort of traditional precise accounting skills that many accountants have and the wider business organisation orientation, which can have as well. I will consider the architecture, routines and culture together. Each in their separate ways has a central impact on how the finance function is set up and its influence. The example that I draw out here is that if the practices are strongly embedded, they may have a strong, perhaps blocking, perhaps positive impact on how the change requirements triggered by other drivers are played out. Indeed, finance processes may provide the battleground where power and politics play out, with outcomes feeding back again into how the finance function is set up. In relation to strategy, it is clear that the nature of the strategy adopted, for a simple example, if you had a high product innovation strategy or a cost leadership strategy, will have a major impact on finance function activities, how they're implemented. However, it's not a clear impact because the research suggests that the relation is not predictable. And again, this is probably due because of the interactive impact of all the other drivers affecting how it works. In relation to size, the example that I'd pull out is that in the smaller organisations, there is a wider scope of responsibilities for individual staff, whereas conversely, in a larger organisation, there will be a narrower set of responsibilities for staff. That will have a direct impact on how the finance function is set up, and for large organisations can lead to increased problems of coordination, making a further difficult issue in relation to the production of good information. Next, ownership and ownership change. I think a key area about the importance of ownership is its impact on the focus of the finance. For example, private equity ownership may bring a focus on short-term financial goals, quoted companies on meeting shareholder expectations, private companies on meeting the goals of owner managers, who may often be willful and may have rather strange goals, and even not-for-profit organisations hopefully will focus on value for money and securing resources to meet charitable objectives. Ownership change is another matter that is of key importance because it can often trigger a major upheaval by moving from one level of focus to another so that the basis of which the accounting function was set up would change. The final organisational driver relates to sectors. It's clear also that sector and technology will have a key impact on how finance function activities are set up. For example, there is a major difference between retailing, banking and large-scale mining. Studies have tried to suggest a range of variables to explain this in a generalisable manner, such as differing dimensions of uncertainty, degrees of competition, technologies in the broadest sense, and distinctions between services and manufacturing industries. However, no consistent correlating patterns have been developed, probably in the same way as strategy, because of the interactive impact of all the other drivers. The final group of drivers that I'll consider we identified is accounting. The first one of these is techniques, which is mainly management accounting techniques. As we're all aware, there's a wide range of these techniques, such as various product costing ways, activity-based costing and the like, for reporting and the analysis of financial information. And these have been developed incrementally over time. However, which one to use is not always clear, and indeed there is a whole pile of tensions on how that choice is made. For example, there are tensions between external reporting and internal analysis. There's tensions between short-term control and long-term strategy. There's tensions between having systems that can respond adaptably when the market changes, but then the information's always changing, versus requirement to maintain stable and consistent reporting. And finally, for example, there's a tension between financial and non-financial indicators. Next, professionalisation. This has had a major impact, especially in the English-speaking world. Examples here of the impact that it's had is it encourages high ethical standards, encourages a high benchmark for technical competence, promotes the importance of accounting, and also promotes convergent practices. In relation to compliance, the practitioner surveys, which were our core source for the activities, in particular stress this, especially with a clear blip during the Sarbucks Enron years in the early 2000s. The specific potential impacts that they were identified include obviously having a direct impact on what the finance function actually does, but with that there's the danger of it crowding out other activities, and also the increased amount of compliance introduces a major risk area which then requires close management. The final point is accounting representation. Accounting has an intrinsic problem in representing operational realities, as it can only be a fuzzy indicator, as many accounting treatments are based on unverifiable assumptions about the future and about the validity of period allocations. On the other hand, there's a general expectation that accounting can give a valid representation of financial outcomes and outlook, preferably with one version of the truth. Consequently, there's a continual underlying tension between the expectation that accounts should be accurate, but the reality that accounts are always liable to be invalidated by future events. So when this tension explodes because the future isn't what we thought it was going to be, its fallout has to be addressed. This can have a major impact, such as pressure, perhaps unrealistic, to improve accuracy, demands for scapegoats and recommendations for the improvement in the future, or even questioning the utility of financial information. So that concludes my brief review of the drivers, where I've just tried to explain that while the model appears very precise, how it actually is implemented in practice will always be different because of this extraordinary wide range of drivers that are interacting. In summary, we've aimed to develop from the evidence this an interlinked framework and explain why that is the case. These findings were developed from a synthesis of prior research, but they were interpreted, and this is crucial, within our pre-understanding as practicing financial professionals. Our test for validity was whether the conclusions fit the understanding of practices. And so on that note, I will hand over to Carolyn, who will give the benefit of her experience of how the proposals fit with what she's been doing.
Thank you, Philip. When we first sat down to discuss this, as an immensely practical person rather than a theoretical person, Philip actually turned to me and said he thought I'd say, "So what?" So rather than disappoint him, "So blimmin' what?" I've run finance departments over the last 20 years, big, small and medium. But when I actually looked at it again, not just to validate what these two have said, but I actually thought that I saw a lot of what actually happens in practice reflected through the model. I've always thought of finance as primarily a customer service function. We only exist in order to support the business, or in this case, the operations. If there's no operation, then there's no finance team producing the transactions or doing all the other things. But customer service is traditionally a very difficult act to pull off. So I guess my first thought on the model was, why is customer service for a finance function so tricky? And three issues stood out for me. Firstly, as finance professionals, we have to take care of the basics. Whether we like it or not, whether the business feels they need it, that's our baseline of operation. So I'll talk about that when I talk about the produce accounts. So that's a given. We must do that stuff. There's the aspiration versus the practicality. We'd all love to spend our time as finance directors deeply involved in the strategy and the interaction with the media and the investors. But what's the reality? Rick's quotes at the start of the presentation showed that we've been talking about this for 50 years, but why can't we crack it, spend more time on those things? And also, as Philip's talked about, there's a multiplicity of drivers under this standard model, and those seem to pull the finance director in multiple different directions. And the finance director, in my experience, is very thinly spread. So his challenge in delivering excellent customer service across all these different dimensions is actually exceedingly difficult. So it's my practical thoughts and comments that I plan to overlay across the model over the next 10 minutes. So I'll start with the box that I've touched on already, producing accounts. Philip gave you a flavour of what this box is all about, and this for me is very basic. It's expected as the absolute minimum standard of any finance function. It's pretty much like your PC working in the morning. If you come into the office, the PC works, fantastic. You don't exactly rush across the office and pat the IT manager on the back, say, top job. When you chip up early because you're in the middle of month end and you're busy and your PC doesn't work, then you certainly may be going to visit the IT manager there and have something to say about it. Especially in the current climate, my experience says that the CEO wants this done pretty much for the lowest cost. They're not thrilled that you've got an impeccable set of stats to show them. Line managers are really just interested in things that impact them, like getting their expenses processed on time and making sure that when they want to hire somebody, they can come on board quickly. So this, for me, is all about efficiency, it's about effectiveness, and it's about keeping the cost down currently for finance directors. The trade for the FD is how he or she can do this without something going wrong. Obviously, much of the work now is done in shared service centres, especially in bigger companies. It may be done offshore, it may be outsourced. This can mean much less direct control over the production of the accounts than there was in the past, where this was done in your own team. There are SLAs to manage. But for me, this is very much a hygiene factor. You cut too deeply here, you get something wrong, then it more than likely costs you your job. So yes, be cognizant of the fact you've got to do it at low cost and efficiently and effectively, but don't go so deep that you end up being the scapegoat. Box C. When I think about the amount of work being done in this box, it really does depend a great deal on some of the drivers that Philip talked about. Is the business regulated? That's a pretty obvious one. Is it public or private? For some smaller companies, private companies that I've worked with, this is very much an afterthought. They're running lean. They don't have too much money to invest on the finance function. They've got pretty junior staff doing the work in the team. Mistakes arise. We may not want to think about that, but that's the reality of the situation. Not major, not deceptive, but the VAT's not right. The PAYE's not right. Very common in the smaller companies that I work with. The inspection follows, as it will do in due course. You try and be as helpful as possible. You sweep up, basically, afterwards. You probably negotiate a settlement, and that's more cost-effective than putting in place the staff to cover it off in the first place. That's a smaller company. Clearly, at the other end of the spectrum, this approach won't fly for larger businesses which are facing ever greater scrutiny and regulations with armies of finance people focused just on box C. Having lived through one of the audience, I think it was Ben mentioned that the Sarbanes-Oxley, having lived through Sarbanes-Oxley at Reuters with a dual listing, I understand why many businesses chose to delist from the US market and would certainly question how we avoid regulation becoming box ticking, which actually doesn't stop the behaviours it was designed to stop in the first place. So questions around exactly, is it good governance, which was raised for the earlier speaker, or how do we ensure it's good governance rather than box ticking? On to box D, manage and control financial performance. This, for me, is the critical role finance should be playing, supporting the business to maximise financial performance in line with the business strategy. Commonly, it might be called business support, it might be called business analysis in companies, lots of different words for it, but essentially it's at the heart of what the finance function should be doing. It would include things like pulling together a board pack of management information, often, as Philip alluded to, including non-financial metrics as well as financial metrics because of the skills and the capabilities within the finance team to pull that information together. It might include doing financials for a new line of business or a new product line or a new business unit. Many of the finance staff in this box used to control the data themselves. So what I'm seeing is many of them used to own box B as well, before that work was now done, especially in the larger businesses, in shared service centres. And certainly some of the staff that I've interacted with feel that their day job has been taken away from them by moving it away to box B. So there's definitely a tension between box B and box D. At Reuters, where I worked for 12 years, we found that while staff claimed that they wanted to do box D rather than box B, the reality was that they didn't trust the shared service centres in the first place. So we saw a lot of duplication of effort between box D and box B. Others simply didn't understand in moving to box D what high quality analysis really looked like and felt much more comfortable focusing on sort of the box B, the production of the basic numbers. So it required a lot of retraining to move from basic business performance to really good, strong business support. But for me, box D is absolutely at the heart of what the finance team should be doing, regardless of recession or upturn. I think too many people were shocked at the need to really refocus on cash and working capital during this recession. I would suggest that those really are things that we ought to be doing as a matter of course, whether the business is doing well or whether we're in recession. Now, from a good box to an absolutely smashing box, this is the dream box in my mind for finance professionals who really want to make that final great leap from controller to FD. A couple of observations, though, on it. I've seen really, really strong controllers who struggle with this part of the role. because they've never had excellent communication skills. And really, in progressing through the other boxes, through maybe box B or D or C, they haven't needed to have them to do a really good job. Secondly, for a strong FD, this box can take an inordinate amount of time. So in mid-size or larger organisations, I think it really places the onus on the good FD who wants to spend a lot of team time here to make sure he's got the right capability in the team underneath him. When talking to companies, the thing I often say, the first thing is to find yourself the best and strongest financial controller that you can. Get them to take care of box B, box D and box C, and then you can spend your time focusing really as the FD on box C. Because especially when the company's not performing well, when the company's going through a transaction or a turbulent time, driven by those drivers that Philip talked about, then this really does consume a lot of time. You know, I think that box, that circle on the model could be a whole heap larger to represent the amount of time it can take. Last but not least, box F. This is another pretty exciting box for FDs that get lured here before they've sorted out box C, definitely, and box B as well. So this is kind of where everybody wants to be at. Now, while I've been validating the model, I have to say, I had a bit of a fight with Rick and Philip about the words they've used here, and I guess it's specifically the use of the word develop. Yes, in my mind and my practical experience, a good finance team, good FD, should be supporting strategy, even leading the strategy process, contributing data, value-added analysis on business line profitability, pulling together market size and share data, absolutely all of that. But surely it's the business, the CEO and the board, who must develop and therefore own the business strategy, not the finance director. If an FD actually develops the strategy, then surely he or she is conflicted when it comes to target setting, when it comes to remuneration plans. Who then, at that point, is the challenge to the CEO, especially the willful entrepreneurial CEO that Philip talks about? Surely it's right that a CFO maintains some level of distance from the business strategy. Of course, being supportive, but being objective and challenging of that strategy. He doesn't want to give the business a classic excuse for opting out on the numbers. So I'm sure many of you in the room have heard the thing I've heard at Reuters and elsewhere. Gets to the end of the year, division misses numbers. Yeah, then the dialogue starts over why they've missed the numbers and who's going to lose their job and what have you. That all kicks off, and the MD stands up and says, "Well, I didn't buy the numbers in the first place. They just came from finance." So we must be cognizant of what, as finance people, we want to be involved in the strategy, we want to use the strategy to drive the setup of the finance function. We need to make sure we maintain an appropriate amount of distance so that we can provide the challenge. That concludes my walkthrough and some practical observations on the model. I just wanted to conclude with some closing remarks. In my experience, a key issue for all finance teams at the moment is they are massively stretched. More and more is added, not on any one particular box, but across the whole system. More and more is added, and very little is ever taken away. At the same time, the FD is being asked to do it for less money and at lower risk. In smaller businesses, as Philip alluded to, the FD is additionally playing a sweeper role across the business. So they're probably picking up property, insurance, legal, HR. So the job in some ways, in my mind, is often becoming an impossible an impossible ask on the finance director. So a key observation for me is, and a key task for the FD, is to consider the function in terms of both supply as well as demand. A lean team may simply not be able to manage all the demands that are being placed on it. Beyond the minimum obligations, the things in box B that we absolutely have to do, it's maybe fine if the CEO and board accept that the quality of customer service isn't going to be as high because they want to run a very lean team. But that conversation needs to be very explicit so everybody understands what's being asked, what resources are being given to the FD to service. And so it's almost negotiating the service level agreement between the finance function and the business based on the amount of resource available, people, systems, training, whatever. But if you don't have that conversation and make that conversation explicit, then there's a great danger in my mind for a finance function that you'll try and do all the boxes and end up not doing a great job on any of them, or you'll focus on one or two of the boxes and the other stuff just won't be happening, because you're sure as eggs are eggs, if the finance director isn't picking up these things, then probably nobody else is. So with those practical observations, then I'll pass back to Rick for some concluding remarks and then take some questions.
Thanks, Caroline. To our mind, this sort of gets us to focus on three main areas that we need to look at the whole system and indeed the whole finance subsystem in relation to the organisation. That the whole model is complex and pervaded by uncertainty, and if we buy into those two, then the need is to focus on adaptability or lack thereof of the finance function. I'm just going to say a few words on each so we've got plenty of time for questions. So first of all, as we've seen, finance functions activities are interrelated and they're part of a complex system, and they're a system in their own right or a subsystem. So perhaps we need to spend a bit more time looking at the functions in relation to one another. So not just management accounting in isolation, but management accounting with financial reporting, tax, cash management, treasury, and so on. We'd like to think more about finance as a department. We see quite a lot of work done around accountants as individuals, but not as teams, as groups of people and the whole work that they do as a team. And how, in particular importance for us, how that fits in to organisational performance. How does the finance function contribute to financial performance? How does it interact with other functions around the organisation? As I say, we see the model as very complex and has pervasive uncertainty, and we've heard talk of uncertainty earlier this morning. So I think this has a huge number of implications. I just want to pick up on two. Best practice approaches. You know, how does best practice fit in with such an uncertain and complex model? And also this sort of perceived wisdom about the linear progression from technical accountant to business partner. As we've heard, this has been an aspiration for a long, long time. Maybe that aspiration is there because it's so difficult to achieve, and in fact sometimes it's not the right thing for the organisation. There are a number of ways that finance needs to play out. And so that's why we think we need to focus on the adaptability of the finance function. If it's complex, if it's uncertain, you can't map out a planned future and then spend 5 years getting there, because that's not going to happen. So the activities and scale, the shape of the activities, needs to adjust and be adaptable on an ongoing basis as the world changes. So those are some very, very high-level conclusions that we draw. We have got quite a few concrete implications, but we'd rather hear from you and get some comments and feedback back on the model. Suffice to say that the work we've looked at only scratches the surface in terms of what Mintzberg has asked for, to understand what accountants really do. The surveys give us some indication, but as we know, what people say they do and what they actually do in practice can be somewhat different. So if we're going to help finance functions, we need to really get to grips with the understanding. So we've got some possible discussion points up here. Please don't restrict yourselves to those. But maybe does the model resonate with your understanding and experience of finance functions? Have we picked up all of the high-level drivers, and would you give any particular weighting to any of the drivers that we identified? And then a number of possible areas of implications. So we look forward to taking some questions. If you want to think about it a bit more and email me later, the contact details are there. If you could wait for the microphones, give your name and organisation, that would be helpful. And my colleagues, Robert Hodgkinson, Emma Riddell, are going to jot down some notes to make sure we don't miss them for future work that we do. So with that, I'll hand over to the audience.
Thank you, Rick. It's Kevin Bounds from Briefcase Consulting. I like the model. It resonates well. There's one semantic point I would make, which is when you look at box D, we have manage financial performance. And I think that's a weakness, because it's managing business performance that's important. And I think if you have that right, you can help address some of the points Caroline was making, because you need different skill sets. And as you graduate from the transaction process and the financial reporting and so on, you need better business knowledge and better communication skills. And on the whole, people don't get trained those. They get technical updates, but the skills to make them successful, they don't get. If your financial controller is handling most of those boxes and the CFO is handling the external relationships, it tends to be the financial controller who presents at the monthly executive committee. And unless that person is grounded and has credibility in relating the financial results to the business performance in terms of the non-financials, he will never make that progression. So I think it's an important semantic, and if you get that right and give that person the support and training, it provides the development. If you don't do that, the organization sees that person as a financial accountant, and the next CFO is an external recruit. So it may be semantic, but I think changing that box would be really quite useful.
That's very helpful. I think, Philip, we've sort of talked about this, if you want to make a comment.
Just a sort of couple of points. I mean, one of the things is obviously that's why I was trying to stress the relationship between the operations and that the box. That at the end of the day, you can only effectively operate the management and control function if you understand the business. And the reason why the financial is because it's the flow of financial transactions, because the only way you can change the financial outcome of a business is by changing its operational activities, because the financial outcomes are a consequence of what the operational activities are. So to change, if you want to manage the finances, you've got to manage the operations, because you can't just do it in a vacuum. So that's why it's there. But then if you take the goal, the simplistic goal that the business is to try and create, meet financial targets, you're doing the targets but by changing the operational actions.
But we're certainly, I think that's a good point, which we will definitely consider whether it, how it fits. There's lots of questions. I'm finding it difficult to take there and then here at the front.
Thanks, Rick.
You should have plenty of time.
Basil Tucker from the University of South Australia. Probably a question in relation to the resonance of the model. Hear your points, acknowledge what you're saying about the importance of a systems-based approach or perspective. But where in the model, or how in the model, is the issue of informal control addressed or incorporated or integrated? Or is it implicit within the model?
My view would be it is definitely implicit. We're not trying to say that all those relationships are formal in any way. A lot of those relationships can be indeed very informal. And we're very keen that things like power and culture are understood when you look at the whole system of finance activities. So if that wasn't clear that we do implicitly have that in the model, then we need to address that.
If I can just sort of add, that's why the drivers are so important, because how they're played out, I mean, they may not be played out at all, I mean, because of all the complex interaction of the drivers, means that what we're saying is underneath everything, under all the fog of how the drivers actually may have played out, there is an underlying constant term of activities, which is basically related to different aggregations of financial transactions turned into reporting. But it's the drivers that differentiate how it works in practice.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
There was a question down the front here. I don't know if we can get a microphone.
I'm slightly concerned that your starting point is operations. If I understand your model right, you sort of go from A through to F in a sort of logical, I mean, I know there's interrelationship, but that seems to be your sort of process. Now, in my view, the business starts with its strategy, not with its operations. If you don't have your strategy, there's no point in having anything else. Therefore, I'm slightly concerned to hear that the finance function, in your view, should stand slightly back from that and effectively be the sort of audit and check function against the business model. I would argue that, that strategy is a discipline that is all of the board and other people's function. Who leads it? Big question. The chief executive ought to. The one department that really should know what's going on entirely in the business is the finance function, so why aren't they getting stuck in there and leading that process and also having a very close relationship with the non-financial indicators, which are as important as the financial ones, really making that sing? And I'm not hearing that. I'm hearing much more of the traditional finance model, which slightly worries me.
I wasn't for one moment suggesting that finance should be not involved with the strategy. I just think, for me, there's a difference between leading the process, being intimately involved with understanding and supporting the strategy, but at the end of the day, the person who signs off on it or owns it, I feel, should be the chief executive, not opting out and giving that to the finance person. And I agree, the CFO would be on that ball. We had that debate the other day, but I think that's a collective decision and not something that the board or the CEO ought to delegate to finance. I think it's too important.
I think that we could have built the model up in any way. We could have started with strategy and worked around. We decided to go that way as a logical way of doing it, but we could have started with strategy and built it down the other way. There's no reason, and we're saying it's a whole system. We're also saying there's no one size fits all. So to say the CFO should always be core to strategy or whatever, it's going to vary enormously depending on culture, the training of individuals. In Japan, it's going to be very different from the UK. So there's no sort of this is how it has to be. Clearly, we have a role as the Institute to help train and get the best possible training to our members, but there's no it has to be this way. What we're trying to do is just classify the activities and some of their interrelationships to help us better understand and perhaps get beneath this sort of, oh, let's be involved in strategy. Well, what does that actually mean? How does it build up? How is it derived? And also understand how, yes, there are different ways that strategy comes to light. It's not just a top-down process. It can be emergent and so on and so forth. Philip, if you want to add anything.
The reason we start with the operations is they're the trigger of the financial transactions, which is the bit that flows through from the A to the F, which is the sort of first point. So that's why we started the operations. And secondly, we did actually nearly put the line in between strategy and operations, and we didn't put the line in because we said we're actually focusing on the finance functions and we didn't want it to be a model of the whole organisation. But, it nearly went in the line, so that might be something we'd want to think about as well.
Yeah. We need to express that better if we're missing it. There's a question here. There's a question from David at the back and one more there. I think if we keep to those three questions, we'll just about be in time, hopefully.
David Johnson, CMA Limited. Sorry to ask a second question, but a word I didn't hear mentioned that used to be a very basic term and was perhaps missing in RBS and Enron and other organisations that have collapsed. And it resonates very much with what Carolyn was saying about the distinction between the finance function and the board function is the word stewardship. I didn't hear stewardship being a fundamental aspect of the finance function, and to do that you have to stand back. And you have to say, isn't that borrowing out of balance? We shouldn't do this.
Yep.
Rather than say, yes, we must go for this new market in China.
Absolutely. I mean, stewardship is in there. In fact, it's one of the surveys, Deloitte and Touche, I think, in particular, have their model of stewardship as one of the sort of core quadrants of the role of the FD. And it's certainly a key part of that centre box, and indeed in the compliance and accounts.
And also the produce accounts bit. I mean, I didn't probably emphasise it enough, but one of the three things that I said there was transaction processing, producing reports, and internal control, protecting assets, and which would cover the stewardship function.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, so at the top level, I mean, I suppose in the broadest sense you could include it in risk. And risk, we really struggled with how to include risk in the model because it's sort of all over the show in terms of the surveys and the evidence, and the definitions are very poor. So in a sense, that higher-level stewardship can get wrapped up in risk. But it's an important thing to distinguish where that role exists, I think. Gentleman at the back, and then David to wrap up.
Steve News from Manchester Metropolitan University. I'm probably going to build on the point that the gentleman said at the front. I do believe there should be an arrows between A and F because it makes it more cyclical. And I don't envy the task of trying to correlate all the business drivers and put it into that model and make it as generic as possible. But from a manufacturing, and probably the same in the service industry as well, is by missing those two arrows from operations, there's still this divide, and it doesn't help with change and engagement because you feel, from an operations point of view, that it's done to you rather than being engaged in and influencing that decision.
Right. I mean, the reason we drew it how we did, and we did debate long and hard as to whether to have that direct arrow, is we almost sort of saw that potentially as picking up the whole system and having that sort of direct, the marketing guy going direct to operations and interacting. And in a sense, potentially bypassing finance. And so we sort of put it through that middle box. But there seems to be a lot of, in terms of testing and validating the model with people, that maybe that arrow needs to be in there. So we're pleased that people are picking up the same issue that we did. So we'll certainly look at that again. Well, there is that, we do see that key interaction between that control performance in the middle and operations, and that has to be very close, and understanding the business. And again, that's another term that's just bandied around. You need to understand the business, and we'd really like to get beneath, okay, what does it mean to understand the business? How do you get better at understanding the business? And that connection with operations is fundamental, and actually getting finance people to do, I mean, we've spoken to people where they send their finance function into the field to actually understand the business. So Caroline, I don't know if you want to comment on how you achieve that, understand the business in your experience.
I mean, it's hard, but like you say, rotating people out of finance, and in some ways, with shared service centres now, it's even harder to get those people cycled through the business and close enough to the business so that they can really add value. But by secondments out, by even sending people through internal audit so they get out and about, but less in the checking role and more doing it in a constructive way at the front end rather than at the back end.
And we need to accept that sometimes they do, and also that sometimes they've been involved in this value creation since the 50s and 60s, as we've seen. David, I think we've just got time for one more question.
David Ottley, Lancaster University Management School. I was a little bit surprised that your model seemed to have no explicit mention of non-financial information. I mean, you slurred from financial control towards management control and didn't really mention the very different sorts of information that's required in that. And so if I put it as a question, what's the training that accountants get to enable them to be competent in the development and design and running of non-financial performance measurement systems, which many of them actually end up doing? Or to put the question in a more pointed way, what's the comparative advantage of the accountant in this function? There are other specialists who do get into it, but it does often seem to be it's the finance function that actually gets that job. So how does that fit into the model?
Shall I take that, or do you want to take
that? Well, it was taken out.
it's funny, we took a slide out, which had three things on, one of which was non-financial information. And on the one hand, we're thinking, well, finance has always been involved in non-financial information. It's had to look at recovery rates on man overhours. It's been involved in headcount at a level. But clearly we're seeing a demand to be much more holistic in the look at non-financial information, that finance should be at the heart of it, consolidating information, and so on. And you ask about what's finance's comparative advantage, and I think that's a very, very important question. I think sometimes they don't. We've seen The Economist recently talking about how data, and relates to Al's view, data becomes so huge in volume that actually what you need is actual number crunches, back to not understanding, but just crunch the numbers. On the other hand, we think that finance people do have some comparative advantage. They have got a degree of analytical skills that they bring to the party. They have got this ability to make sure that the information is complete and so on. They do have interpretative skills that can translate across to non-financial information. And in our experience, a lot of non-financial information is very inaccurate compared to the financial stuff, so they can bring the disciplines to it. So it's a combination, I think, of the analytical skills that they should be developing and applying those across to the non-financials. But there are sometimes, I think, when they maybe should just get out of the way in terms of the non-financials. Caroline?
I mean, to your specific question, I don't think they're really trained to do it. I think it ends up in the function because when you leave it outside, what I've seen in practice is, you know, it appears in one month's report, but only that month because it was a good indicator, and then the next month it's sadly absent, and you sort of dig underneath the detail and ask where it's gone, and it's disappeared because it was rubbish that month. So I think there's a certain point around integrity and, you know, capability within the finance function to report things systematically, but they're not trained to do it, and often that's added, you know, onto the existing team in addition to the day job they're doing. Well, that's what I see in practice.
We're going to have to cut the questions there, I'm afraid, but if you do want to catch us, we are around and really interested in hearing your further thoughts. Thank you for the input. We will be using those to develop the paper further, so that's been very valuable for us. Thank you very much.